This is Audible.
The Zombie Chapters, Volume 1, by Daniel Feit. Read for you by Ethan Sawyer. Copyright 2013 by Daniel Feit. Edited by Derek Lakin. Cover art by Cameron Orr.
Preface. Welcome to Serial Fiction with Zombies. The Zombie Chapters is a bi-weekly serial intended for readers who love cliffhangers and post-apocalyptic survival stories and zombies. As the story progresses, I explore what life would be like if the world as we knew it came to an abrupt end. How would we, the secretaries, computer geeks, scientists, teenagers, moms, and school teachers of the everyday world, cope with the bursting of those deceptively fragile bubbles that envelop and protect us? You know, those subtle details that we never think about. National infrastructure, social norms, governmental organizations, the rule of law. What if, one terrible night, they all went away? And suppose the bad news didn't end there? What if a new, incomprehensible threat began to grow inside of us like a malignant infestation, and we began to realize that the threat was inherently unstoppable because it was born of us? And that's it right there, isn't it? Zombies are, in essence, us. They may be cleverly disguised in Hollywood makeup and computer animation, but they are still us. Single-minded consumers, utterly self-focused, and imbued with a soul-deep need that can never be sated. Yep, that's us all right. Sigmund Freud would have had a field day with the zombie genre. With that said, this isn't a, quote, zombie book. Well, there are zombies, lots of them. But this book isn't about pistol-packing, indestructible, except for the ever-present buddy who sacrifices himself for the main character and his girlfriend, ex-Navy SEALs mowing down row after row of flesh-eating automatons. Don't get me wrong, I read and loved books like those, but for a while now, I've been wanting to craft a story that examines the impact of a zombie apocalypse on the real world and the real people who live in it. But why a serial? I chose a serial format for two big reasons. First, I love the raw awesomosity, it's a word now, of the all-powerful cliffhanger. I love having to wait to find out what happens next. I think some of us have forgotten what that's like, waiting a day, a week, or even, gasp, a whole month in blissful, nail-biting agony to see or read what happens next. Only to be left with tantalizing new questions until next time. The ebook format of The Zombie Chapters will be released on a bi-weekly schedule with 2 to 3 chapters in each release. So the wait won't be too long and the content delivered in each installment is intended to be enough to satisfy your zombie cravings, yet leave you wondering what new horrors I will unleash upon your favorite characters in the next installment. Second, I truly don't know when and where this story will come to an end. Never fear, I know where this train is headed. I'm just not sure how many stops we'll hit along the way. I'm not sure who will get on and who will get off at each of those stops. So, if you are brave enough, I invite you to join me for the best part of this brand new journey, the journey itself. One last thing, you haven't skipped to chapter 1 yet? This serial is about the lives of various characters, not all of whom are interconnected in any way. I am a big fan of George R.R. Martin's Game of Thrones series, and one of the big draws for me was the incredible variety of storylines he has created, and the way the novels move between the perspectives of various characters. I never got bored with those incredible books, as each storyline was intriguing in and of itself, and yet I always had my favorite characters to look forward to reading more about. The Zombie Chapters is similar to that work, in that I have created multiple storylines that are designed to explore and illuminate different aspects of the same overarching story. Enjoy. Daniel N. Feit. Dedication. This work is dedicated to my amazing wife. Thanks to her, the last 20 years of my life have been as exciting as, well, a zombie apocalypse, but in a good way and with less gore.
Warning, this book contains profanity, zombies, death, mutilation, zombies, fresh ideas, dismemberment, real character development, zombies, and cliffhangers. It is not intended for younger readers or the faint of heart. You've been warned. Introduction. Death borders upon our birth, and our cradle stands in the grave. Joseph Hall. Chapter 1. Brad Thomas, 33,000 feet, and falling. Brad clutched at his armrests as the plane shuddered and dropped. Seized by sudden fear, he jerked his gaze to the starboard wing, sure that he would see it sheared off by the sudden movement. It wasn't, of course, but in the non-stop lightning flashes outside, he could see the length of the wing shake violently. Sitting in 17D, just aft of the small jet's starboard wing, Brad could also see the storm clouds that enveloped him. Some of the jagged electrical streaks erupting from the storm were so huge that they illuminated the entire sky. Brad shifted, trying not to bump the elbow of the elderly lady in the aisle seat next to him, and pulled back his sleeve to check his watch. It was 9:13 p.m. He was 2 hours into a nearly 4-hour flight from Milwaukee to Seattle. He had been watching the storm drawing closer and closer for the last hour, and now the maelstrom had his regional jet firmly in its teeth.
"You'll be okay, you know," the lady next to him said.
She patted his forearm in a grandmotherly gesture. Brad forced a smile and nodded. She was the classic little old lady, blue hair and all. He was about to reply when the plane jumped once more. Some kid a few rows up squealed delightedly as the plane bounced. She had been giggling and shrieking merrily every time the plane shook. Twice now, the pilot announced that he was truly sorry for the bumpy ride and that he would be adjusting the plane's altitude to find smoother air. The kid didn't care. She was having the time of her life as Brad, an adult in his late 30s, was miserable as hell. Either Captain John, whatever his name is, wasn't looking hard enough, or there wasn't any smooth air to find. Brad thought the latter must be true, given what he was witnessing outside his window. Illuminated by the constant flashes of light in the sky, he saw what looked like an enormous valley of darkness. The dark abyss was filled with towering black cloud structures extending so high that Brad couldn't see their tops. A gray mass of roiling clouds formed the valley's floor beneath them, undulating and squirming like an army of restless wraiths. Suddenly, the tail end of a plane lurched sideways as if smacked aside by some unseen giant. Brad banged his head against the plexiglass window as the aircraft fell into a gut-punching drop. He heard moans and a few nervous chuckles around him as the plane leveled off again a moment later. The damn little girl up front burst into her loudest shriek of joy yet as Brad heard the engines thunder to life and felt the plane claw its way back to its original altitude. He picked up his plastic cup, long devoid of the soft drink he had ordered, and swirled the remaining ice chips nervously. He checked his watch again. 9:15. Why was it that time went by so damn slowly when he was having a rough flight? It seemed as though there was a direct correlation between the amount of turbulence rocking the plane and the speed at which the minute hand rotated around the dial. To be more precise, Brad thought, maybe the correlation was to the amount of misery and fear that gripped him. Perhaps his watch sensed his discomfort, like a polygraph machine sensed a lie, and it put the brakes on just to prolong the show. The watch was, after all, an inexpensive congratulations-on-getting-laid-off gift from a former boss who never really liked him. Thanks for giving us 8 years of your life. Don't call us. We'll call you. Maybe the damn watch was cursed. Being a business development guy, Brad was a firm believer in all sorts of superstitions. He had lost multi-million-dollar sales over the most improbable of causes, and had landed big contracts for equally incomprehensible reasons. As such, Lady Luck and Bad Juju had years ago become the juxtaposed gods that ruled his professional destiny. Brad smiled wryly to himself.
It amazed him how his brain went off on wild tangents anytime he was in the air. Perhaps it was a self-defense mechanism, its way of creating a distraction from the myriad catastrophes that could befall the plane. Rather than dwell on them, his conscious mind delved into the silliest, most nonsensical bullshit it could drum up. Either that or maybe I'm just going loco. That would be my luck. Brad looked out the window again, the brown plastic frames of his glasses rattling against the plastic. The plane was vibrating constantly now. A low, unnatural rumble filled the cabin as if the aircraft was growling defiantly at the storm that was trying to rip it from the sky. The streak of bright, greenish light that lanced down through the cloud valley took him completely by surprise. It was gone in less than a second, and at first Brad thought his nerve-racked mind was inventing still more fanciful things to occupy its time. But he hadn't imagined it. That much he knew by instinct. A meteorite? Now the sky is throwing rocks at us? Brad was about to turn to the lady next to him and ask if she, too, had seen it, when a second meteorite flashed through a tower of clouds far ahead. The entire column glowed an iridescent green for a split second, before another massive lightning bolt relit the sky, drowning out the faint green glow. Two meteorites? What are the odds of seeing two meteorites on the same flight? A moment later, Brad found himself staring dumbly out his window as three, four, and suddenly scores of meteorites rocketed out of the overhead clouds into the dark void of sky outside the plane. They disappeared with bright green splashes into the solid cloud deck beneath them. He watched the display in mesmerized silence for a few seconds before the chorus of exclamations and gasps around him fully registered in his mind. Turning to look at the other passengers, he saw that every last one of them was staring out through their nearest window. Even the flight attendant stopped in the middle of the aisle and was leaning over a passenger to see what was going on. There was a feeling of dread swelling in the back of his mind, a dangerous realization crouching in his subconscious, waiting to pounce. When Brad recognized that he was seeing bright green flashes outside of the plane's port side windows as well, the reason for his sense of doom finally leapt, fully formed, into his mind. He wasn't flying next to the most intense otherworldly meteorite shower he had ever seen. He was flying through it. Worse yet, this meteorite storm wasn't high above them, where meteorites typically burned away harmlessly. No, these rocks had entered the atmosphere and were falling far enough to make it down to where his plane was. Hell, it looked like some might even make it all the way to the ground. Turning back to his window, Brad watched as the sky filled with brilliant green slashes of light. A steady curtain engulfed the plane, hemming it in more and more tightly every moment. And if even one of those space rocks hits the plane? The captain must have had the same thought. Brad heard the airliner's engines boom to life, their steady growl replaced by a high-pitched wail. He felt himself being forced back in his seat as the regional jet leapt forward. The overhead seatbelt lights flashed several times as the accompanying ding sounded off again and again. Brad heard it 100 times before on other flights. But there was now something insistent about it. Ding, 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 ding. Suddenly the aircraft was diving, nosing over to head almost directly at the ground. Screams of panic erupted around him as the thunder of the airliner's engines grew into a hideous, deafening shriek. Brad gripped his armrests as the rapid descent pinned him into his seat. He saw the flight attendant, caught in the steeply slanting aisle ahead of him, lose her balance, spin, and reach desperately for the back of a passenger seat before crashing face first to the cabin floor. A guy sitting in the seat next to her reached forward and grabbed her. He hoisted her halfway onto his lap, hooking his free arm around her to try and hold her in place. Blood streamed down the woman's face and onto her uniform as her eyes filled with tears. The overhead speakers came to life. Even though the man was practically shouting, Brad had to strain to hear his words.
"Folks, this is First Officer Marichek. Please don't be alarmed. We are..."
His words were drowned out by a cockpit alarm that burst to life in the background. It was instantly recognizable. That insistent, "Ert, ert, ert, ert." Brad heard it in countless movies whenever something had gone very, very wrong with an aircraft. The first officer cut off the audio. That alarm was one sound Brad never imagined he would hear in person. It was one thing hearing it through your surround sound home entertainment system while watching Tom Cruise spiral out of control in an F-14 Tomcat. It meant something totally different when you were tens of thousands of feet in the air, when you heard it. In that moment, Brad knew that he was going to die. Fear gripped his chest like an iron claw, constricting his breathing as paralyzing numbness radiated up his spine until his face was awash in heat. The alarm seemed to have the same effect on his fellow passengers as their screams and shouts became a cacophony of vocalized terror. The plane's dive seemed to grow even deeper as it bucked and jumped through the roiling air. Through the window, Brad could see more green streaks of death zooming by them, seeking them out, mocking the pilot's best attempts to outrace them. Marichek's voice returned on the overhead speakers. He had evidently cut off the cockpit alarm, but his voice sounded even more strained. He spoke rapidly.
"Folks, we're descending quite intentionally and everything is okay. Please sit tight. Gladys, please buckle in."
Brad doubted Gladys heard any of what Marichek said. She was sprawled across the lap of the guy in 6B as he fought to keep her from tumbling further down the nearly vertical aisle. Her legs were splayed behind her, and her hands were covering her bloody face as she bawled uncontrollably. The first officer's message contained no mention of the bombardment of meteorites all around them, and Brad had to bite off a rising burst of maniacal laughter at the man's cliché phrasing, "Please sit tight, but what if I want to take a piss before a space rock slams into us and breaks the plane in half?" Brad assumed "everything is okay" meant that the plane had not yet been struck by a meteorite. Still, if the pilot was diving, that meant he was taking evasive maneuvers, and that thought chilled Brad to his core. The captain was racing to get out of a life-or-death situation as fast as he could. "I bet that little girl up front isn't laughing now." The thought came unbidden. It was cruel, and Brad chastised himself for it. It would be best not to go before the judgment throne with his last thought being one of sarcastic cruelty toward one of his little creations. Thousands of green-tailed meteors were now lancing downward all around them. One flashed so closely that it left him momentarily blinded, and he could swear he heard a whip-crack zip as it sped past. Seconds later, they were in the cloud bank he'd seen below the aircraft earlier. An intense barrage of lightning engulfed them as the enraged air all around them rocked the plane fiercely. It felt as if they were in a giant version of one of those holiday snow globes, except that their winter wonderland was being shaken by a malevolent god who was either really pissed off or who simply took sadistic pleasure from their terror. Even in the cloud bank, and despite the bright flashes of lightning, Brad clearly saw the vertical shafts of green light rush past as the meteorites continued to seek out the plane. Just one hit would be the end of them, and more were coming so close that their intensely bright tails made Brad look away from his window as they raced by. Time stopped as terror battered at the gateway to his sense of reality. He knew if that door should fail, sheer, uncontrollable panic would be let loose. He wanted to scream, to beg the terror to stop its assault, and, failing that, to run for the aircraft door and make his escape. Brad felt the old lady next to him grab his arm in a surprisingly strong vice grip. Glancing down, he saw her skeletal hand, pale as ice, wrapped around his bicep. Her fingernails bit painfully into his flesh, and he could just make out her low, tortured moan. He heard the guy in front of him cry out in barefaced fear. A woman sitting behind him was screaming non-stop at the top of her lungs. Brad thought of his wife and kids. "Will they know how I died? Will they ever be able to understand what this was like?" He suddenly pictured his oldest daughter in a quaint little church in their hometown of Sonrisa, Texas. She was dressed in an ornate white wedding dress, but he could see only the outline of her face through her veil. He saw an empty chair next to his wife, his chair, but he would never be there. Tears flowed down his cheeks as he finally stopped thinking, stopped looking out the window. He clenched his eyes closed, locking in the image of his wife, and waited for everything to end. Brad wasn't sure how much time had passed, but with one final violent shake, The airliner began to level off. Brad waited for the torture to begin anew. But although the aircraft was still buffeted by turbulence and lightning illuminated the cabin every few seconds, the plane seemed to be okay. He still heard screams and shouts all around him, but the intense roar of the engines had waned. He reluctantly opened his eyes. He noticed the crumpled plastic cup of ice in his hand, although he didn't remember picking it up. It was now an oblong ball, its cold liquid seeping through his fingers. He saw the elderly lady's white-knuckled hand still on his bicep and the top of her blue-haired head as she slumped against him. Brad watched the flight attendant as she sat up, disengaging from the passenger's arms. Her body still shook with occasional sobs as she looked around the cabin. She wiped her cheek and smeared blood all over her ear and into her hair. She glanced down at her shaking hand, saw the blood, and began sobbing in earnest once more. Glancing out his window, Brad realized that the meteorite shower had stopped and let out a breath. He reached over and patted the old lady's hand a couple times. "We're okay. Hey, it's okay," he said, trying to console her. She seemed to hear him and relaxed her hold, though her hand remained on his arm. He couldn't see her face as she remained slumped against him, but he was sure the poor old thing was as traumatized as he, if not more so. Brad smelled vomit and the undeniable stench of defecation. For a moment he was worried that he had shit himself, but realized that the odor was coming from somewhere ahead of him. He certainly couldn't blame whoever it was for losing control of their bowels. Never in his life had he experienced such terror. He looked around the plane and could see hesitant relief on the shocked faces of the other passengers. Most seemed to be stirring from their positions and were looking around the aircraft. The cabin was a mess. Baggage doors were open, their contents littering the floor. Several of the little overhead compartments had popped open to disgorge oxygen bags. They hung limply by tendrils of clear plastic tubing, and their yellow cups danced around lightly in the remaining turbulence. Brad watched as the cockpit door opened and one of the pilots began to emerge. The door smacked into the flight attendant's metal drink cart, which was leaning over in front of it. The flight crewman reached through, righted the cart, and pushed the door open. Brad noticed the front of the man's shirt was wet as he made his way aft. He looked around at the cabin's debris, clearly dismayed by what he saw. He was tall and dark-haired and had the angular facial features of a rugged Marlboro Man type of guy. Brad wondered if he was the pilot or the first officer. What was his name again? Marino? The man made his way quickly to the flight attendant, Gladys, who looked up at him wide-eyed. He helped her up to her feet as she struggled to get her legs back under her within the tight confines of the aisle. Once she was steady, the two made their way to the front of the plane, stepping over luggage, blankets, pillows, and other debris as they moved. Once there, they conferred with each other quietly as Gladys wiped off her face with a small towel. Nodding at something the pilot said, she squeezed around the drink cart and made her way into the plane's restroom. The pilot ducked into the cockpit for a minute, then returned and retrieved a rectangular medical kit from one of the compartments above the tiny kitchen area. A man's voice came over the speaker system.
"Ladies and gentlemen, this is Captain Harris."
The guy spoke with an unmistakable Boston accent.
"I apologize for that rough spot. We needed to get out of there in a hurry. Everything is fine, and I want to reassure you that we have everything under control."
There was a clear, unspoken "but" in his last sentence, and Brad cringed, waiting. The other passengers, he noted, stared forward as if they could see the captain through the steel cockpit door.
"We are in intermittent contact with a regional airport and are going to set the plane down there to assess the aircraft."
Worried glances were exchanged throughout the cabin. Intermittent contact? Assess the aircraft? The pilot continued.
"We are experiencing some communications interference, and while the aircraft is operating just fine, FAA regulations dictate that we land at the nearest airfield. First Officer Marichek has informed me that some of you may be in need of medical attention. If you are injured, please make your way to the front of the plane. Gladys and Officer Marichek will assist you. If any passengers have medical training, we'd appreciate your help up front as well. If you are doing okay, we ask that you remain in your seat with your seatbelt fastened for the duration of the flight. We should be landing in Helena, Montana in 20 to 30 minutes. Thank you."
A soft click ended the pilot's address. Several passengers immediately rose and started making their way to the front of the plane. One, a teenager, cradled his arm. Another was bleeding profusely from his nose. By the time they arrived, Gladys had re-emerged from the restroom. She had washed off most of her blood, but a nasty, reddish-black bruise marred nearly half of her face. She still looked dazed, but to her credit, she started treating the injured passengers alongside the first officer. Brad looked at his watch. 9:31. Fewer than 20 minutes had passed since he had seen the first meteorite. Was that even possible? As he repositioned himself, the old lady's hand slipped away. He glanced down and saw it laying motionlessly on her lap. Lady? Brad nudged at her. Lady! Turning, Brad tried to ease her off his shoulder. Her head lolled back with the movement, and he found himself staring into her flat, dead eyes. Chapter 2. Dr. Ramsey Claiborne. Conrad Memorial Hospital. Ramsey had always considered the high-pitched, whiny voice on the other end of the line to be one of the most annoying sounds he had ever heard. He hadn't told her that until after their divorce was finalized, but even then she had slapped him. She had a propensity for that, he discovered years ago, which she lovingly nurtured and perfected over the course of their marriage. He never hit her back, of course, nor did he ever try to dodge the blows. He took them as they came, and afterward tried to figure out what prompted the outburst to begin with, usually without success. That slap, delivered on the Bexar County Courthouse steps, was the last and best one she had ever stung him with. It had left him dizzy for a good minute or two. That was okay, he figured. That one, at least, was deserved. Dr. Ramsey Claiborne's thoughts drifted back in time as his ex-wife prattled on about her upcoming vacation. He had been in the ROTC in college and completed 8 years of active service in the United States Air Force in order to repay his country for putting him through medical school. He spent the majority of that time at AFLID, the secretive, high-tech Air Force Laboratory for Infectious Diseases. Having learned more than he ever wanted to know about the multitude of microorganisms that could kill a whole lot of people very quickly, he exited the service to join the more lucrative world of private medicine. He met Catherine at a deli on a rainy February day after he stopped in to grab a foot-long Italiano sub. He had been working 12 to 16-hour shifts as an intern in the emergency room of one of San Antonio's largest downtown hospitals, and liked to get a large sandwich that he could munch on periodically throughout the shift. He was next in line to pay when he overheard the lady in front of him apologize for forgetting her purse. On a whim, he paid for her lunch, and they struck up a conversation, which ended with her pledging to contact him the next day to repay the favor. They met at the same restaurant the following afternoon, and, true to her word, she paid for his lunch. Catherine, he discovered, was a real estate agent for a company headquartered in San Antonio, and as they ate together, Ramsey found that he earnestly enjoyed her sense of humor. His chaotic schedule didn't allow for much in the way of a social life, so her company was a welcome change. Ramsey couldn't remember much about the dating phase of their relationship. His work hours were unpredictable and extremely long, and she showed houses in the evenings and on the weekends. It seemed that they almost never had time to spend with one another. As a result, he had been thoroughly surprised when she broached the subject of marriage. He hadn't thought she was taking their sporadic relationship so seriously. Looking back, he now understood that his proposal stemmed from the realization that, with a schedule like his, he wasn't likely to meet anyone else anytime soon. Had he been more mature, he now knew, he would have recognized the enormous mistake he was making. Catherine was pregnant 2 years later, which blew her career to shreds. The real estate industry was all about who you know, she once explained, and because she stayed home for the first year of Jonathan's life, she lost contact with most of her leads. Around the same time, she asked Ramsey to transfer out of the ER department and get a normal doctor job so that he could spend more time with her and the baby. He adamantly refused. He loved his job in the ER, the constant balancing act, the adrenaline rush of caring for patients who needed urgent intervention, the awesome feeling of saving someone's life, even when they had been too stupid to call a cab rather than try to drive home with a blood alcohol content level that was off the chart. He refused to give all of that up. That was when he received the first slap. She delivered it as he finished a monologue on the reasons why he wouldn't leave his internship at the ER. She didn't say a word. She just stared at him for a few moments, slapped him, and walked off. Ramsay followed her, trying angrily to explain his rationale once more. If she heard any of it, she gave no sign. Things had seemed to settle down after that, although he noticed a new coolness between them. He left the ER and accepted a more stable job after his internship was complete. But by then, it didn't matter. Jonathan was 4 years old, and Catherine hardly spoke to him anymore. They remained unhappily married for another 3 years, until she announced that she had met another guy, one who actually paid attention to her. She had already arranged all the details. The moving company arrived the same day, and within hours, she and his son were gone. Ramsay's world had disappeared in a single afternoon. Only then did he realize his many mistakes. It was as if someone yanked back the curtain in his mind and shouted, "Ta-da, dumbass!" Every cold shoulder, every missed birthday party, every hurtful word, every prideful retort that he'd given her, all rushed into his memory like a stampede of broken promises. Just as Catherine had taken their dating life far more seriously than he had, so too had she taken their marriage more seriously. The feelings of loss and utter loneliness were overwhelming those first few months. His stomach felt like a bottomless pit had been carved into it. He couldn't eat or sleep. He couldn't concentrate enough to drive. At first, he repeatedly called in sick, and then he was forced to take a semi-permanent leave of absence. Eventually, the hospital board canceled his contract altogether. The one advantage or disadvantage of being a medical doctor is having easy access to depression medication. In no time, he was addicted to diazepam and was washing down Percocet with Jack Daniel's whiskey. He wanted to stay too numb to care about winning the war that was raging in his soul over his guilt. If he never fired back at whatever malicious emotional mechanism bombarded his mind with accusations and regret, it wasn't really a battle, was it? He lost his car in 3 months, and his house in 6. He stayed at various homeless shelters for the next year and contemplated suicide with ever greater frequency, until Catherine showed up one morning at the Dos Brazos shelter. How she had found him, he never knew. She set him up in a motel room and got him cleaned up. Over the course of 4 weeks, she helped him to kick the drugs and, more importantly, helped him cope with the emotional turmoil. What was done was done. He couldn't change it, and he finally accepted it. During those weeks, they discovered a level of friendship and trust previously unknown to them. She became his confidant, and in many ways, he thought, he finally became the man that she always needed. He leaned into her emotionally, absorbed her presence, truly listened to her, and finally saw the compassionate person that he married. The flame never reignited in Catherine as it had in Ramsay, however, and despite his best efforts, the divorce went through. They resumed their fighting stances during the process as they slugged out the legalities of dividing joint assets and agreeing on custody. But there was at least an undercurrent of understanding between them.
"Are you zoning out on me again?"
Her irritated tone brought his mind sharply back to the present.
"Kath, yes. I mean, no. I already know you're leaving on Tuesday. I know you're coming back on the 17th. Jonathan's going to be fine. You need to stop worrying."
"Great. The last thing I need is for her to think I was ignoring her. I'd never hear the end of it." He waited for the fiery retort, but instead, he heard a resigned sigh.
"Fine. I'll be over Monday night."
Her reply was slow and weary.
"What is her deal?"
"That's fine, Kath, like I said." He paused.
"What's wrong?"
"Tired?" He heard a release in her voice as her words flowed more freely.
Just, you know, same old shit. Max is being a real ass, and I don't know how to get him to understand me."
Maximilian Chesney was the other man, the guy Catherine had left him for. A short, dark-haired, overweight lawyer with a private practice in a particularly shitty part of San Antonio's west side. The majority of his cases involved trying to get immigration papers for illegals. His cases were all about taking money from desperately poor people so that he could pretend to fight what he already knew to be a hopeless cause. If there was a single word to describe Maximilian Chesney, it was greasy. And who the hell names their child Maximilian, anyway?
"This trip isn't about me. It's about my mom. The only mom I've got. It's like all he sees are dollar signs, Ram. Like, that's all he cares about. I don't know what to do with that.
Ramsay still couldn't believe that Catherine, an incredibly intelligent woman, fell for a guy like that. That slap in the face hurt more than all of the physical slaps put together. Her voice had a pleading undertone that Ramsay hated and loved at the same time. He liked feeling that subtle hint of dependence, and he longed to be the big, strong shoulder that she could cry on. But he resented the position she put him in when she used that tone. What is she looking for? What the hell am I supposed to do, go deck the guy or something? She married the loser in the first place, and remained married to him despite all the signs that he didn't love her, and in spite of all the changes Ramsay had made. Part of him still refused to believe it was over between them, and he continuously fought to keep that realization from fully forming in his mind. That was a painful door to leave open, but it would be even worse if it finally, irrevocably closed. He had gone down a similar path before, and it had almost destroyed his life. He tried to lighten the conversation.
"Kath, you gotta use guy speak. Be direct. Give him the facts about everything. Let him know how you feel. And hopefully the dipshit doesn't get it and you come running back to me."
"I know, I know. He can be so thick sometimes."
"I would have gone with rotund," she chuckled.
"That's not funny, Ram. At any rate, I'll let you go. I've got a million things to do. Never mind what I said. I'll just call you again on Sunday."
As usual, she hung up without giving him a chance to speak. Ramsay shook his head in dismay. It was like she was fishing for something, but wouldn't invest enough of herself to catch anything. She would just throw out her line, wait a minute or two, reel it back in, and leave.
Shit.
He let out a breath and put his cell phone into his shirt pocket. There was always an odd emotional letdown after speaking with her, especially after she opened up to him about something. Closing his eyes, he leaned back in his black leather office chair and took a deep breath. He loved the solitude of his office on the first floor of Conrad Memorial Hospital and kept the lights off to make his space even more relaxing. The nursing staff consequently referred to his office as the cave and was careful not to disturb him there unless an urgent need arose. Those were rare enough on evening shifts in the small country hospital. During the tumultuous divorce, Ramsay decided to move out of San Antonio and accepted a position at Conrad in the hopes that a more sedentary lifestyle would allow him to get his emotions sorted out. It worked, he supposed, but only to a certain degree. He gave himself a few minutes to clear his mind, then logged back into his computer to finish the discharge summary on the patient in 5A. The idiot had somehow gotten stung in the ass by a scorpion and came in to have it examined. Ramsay prescribed antibiotics, gave the guy ibuprofen, and was about to send him on his way. "It is definitely a different world out here in the country," he thought. A few hours ago, he treated a ranch hand whose foot had been fractured in three places after a cow stepped on it. A frickin' cow. Ramsay was used to treating the victims of violent crimes on night shifts, stabbings, shootings, the occasional bludgeoning with a baseball bat or a crowbar. He vividly recalled trying to save a kid who had taken a load of buckshot to the face after getting caught in the wrong neighborhood with the wrong girl. The boy kept trying to speak, even though Ramsay repeatedly urged him to relax and keep quiet. He was worried that the patient would introduce more blood into his lungs. The boy was in shock, though, and continued gurgling apologies to God knows who. Ramsay rushed him into surgery to try to stabilize him, but an hour later, the 16-year-old became yet another tick mark on the country's gang-related homicide tally. 20 or so miles outside of San Antonio, the only gunshot wounds he dealt with were from occasional hunting accidents. That was just fine with him. Country life suited him quite well. With a population of 4,200, give or take a cow or two, Sonrisa, Texas was mostly a ranching and farming community, although it had grown recently due to the exploding South Texas oil industry. As for Conrad, it was not the labyrinthine super hospital that he was used to, but it had its amenities and even boasted Wilshire County's first modern trauma unit. A brisk knock on the door brought him out of his reverie.
"Come."
He leaned forward on his chair, instantly alert. The nurse who opened the door was one of the best on Conrad's payroll. Emil Rodriguez had only 5 years of post-grad experience, but he was one of the sharpest, not to mention funniest guys Ramsay had ever met. Rodriguez had deft hands, picked up new techniques the first time, every time, and had extraordinary street smarts. He was also fluent in Spanish, and had a knack for calming down even the most hysterical abuelas. The guy was a godsend on each shift he took. The short, broad-shouldered Hispanic man stepped into his office and said, "Doc, you have got to come see this. Come on." The excitement in his voice further awoke Ram's senses. He hadn't known Rodriguez to get excited about much of anything, but the look on the nurse's face was that of a child in a candy store, silly-ass grin and all. "What's up?" he said as he hurried around his desk. "If this is another one of Emil's stupid pranks, I'm going to be pissed."
No. You gotta see this for yourself. Hurry up, boss,"
Rodriguez said as he jogged down the hall toward the ER's entrance. Ramsey had to break into a run to keep pace. They pushed through a security door and through the automatic sliding glass doors that led outside. Ramsey immediately noticed a small crowd, which included Mr. Scorpion victim, and noticed that everyone was looking skyward. He looked up to see what had caught the crowd's attention and halted. The sky had been clear throughout the evening, and by 9 o'clock he could usually see every star there was to see in the South Texas night sky. Now, however, the expanse above him was filled with meteorites. Ramsey remembered watching a Leonid meteorite shower one night after hearing about its upcoming arrival on the news. That shower had impressed him, but it was a pathetic sprinkling compared to this bombardment. He saw tiny, bright streaks in every direction as meteorites burned up and disappeared in the atmosphere. Hundreds of them raced down and died in blazes of fiery green fury every second. "Are meteorites supposed to be green?"
"Jeez," he whispered.
"Pretty cool, huh? Ever see anything like this?"
Rodriguez asked. The word Ramsey would have used was not cool. It was amazing to see, but he couldn't ignore his gut instinct. As far as he knew, meteorite showers of this intensity didn't happen anymore. Perhaps millions of years ago, but not in recent times. Ramsey also thought he noticed a faint discoloration in the sky. He closed his eyes, counted to 3, and opened them again. Yes, it was definitely there. The sky itself was starting to luminesce with a sickly green color.
"No, but do you see that? The sky looks sort of green."
"Yeah, I saw that. Those things are turning the sky green?"
The humor had rapidly drained out of the nurse's voice. After a long pause, Rodriguez added solemnly,
"In the immortal words of Han Solo, I have a bad feeling about this."
The group around Ramsey was starting to murmur worriedly. He tore his eyes away from the mesmerizing show above and looked around. There were perhaps 40 or so people gathered, and several of them were pointing at the sky. He watched a nearby woman step closer to her husband's side with an anxious frown on her face. Ramsey caught sight of the scorpion guy. He was peering skyward as well, tugging on his beard thoughtfully. He glanced at Rodriguez and watched as he reached up and ran a hand through his black hair 3 or 4 times. It was a gesture Ramsey had seen only during the most stressful shifts. Even the cool-headed nurse was getting rattled. Ramsey looked skyward again and immediately saw that the meteorites were falling even farther, penetrating deeper into the Earth's protective atmosphere before burning up. That could mean only one thing. These rocks were larger than the ones he had observed only moments before. He started to see little explosions as some of them burned up, leaving behind small green puffs. One meteorite off to the north especially caught his attention. As it rocketed down, Ramsey saw that it was much larger and its fiery tail noticeably brighter than those surrounding it. As it arced downward, it disintegrated into smaller pieces that, in turn, broke apart and exploded into green puffs a few milliseconds later. The entire show was over in 2 seconds.
That was pretty damned close to ground level.
It had been close enough for him to hear faint pop, pop, pop sounds as the fractured pieces of the space rock blew up. The sounds reminded him of the distant, muffled, gunfire-like crackling of a 4th of July fireworks celebration. A wave of exclamations erupted around him as Ramsey shifted his gaze to the southern sky. Brighter rocks now fell everywhere, and the crowd was barraged with a chorus of ever-louder pops as the projectiles exploded. People around him began slowly stepping back toward the ER doors, and Ramsey was about to order everyone back inside when an explosive boom erupted to his right. Everyone ducked reflexively as a shockwave of deep, rumbling sound washed over them. Startled shouts erupted from the crowd as car alarms blared to life in the adjacent parking lot. Ramsey turned to see where the blast had originated from. Conrad Memorial sat directly on U.S. Highway 181, the main artery linking Sonrisa to San Antonio. On the opposite side of the four-lane highway, he saw a rapidly growing plume of smoke and debris rising from the ground. The meteorite had struck perhaps a mile north of their location.
"Inside now!" he shouted.
The crowd turned and surged for the sliding glass doors. Many of the women were screaming, and Ramsey saw wide-eyed fear as people rushed for the entrance.
"Careful! Don't shove!"
Rodriguez shouted. He was the closest staff person to the sliding glass door, and he wrapped his hand around its edge to prevent it from closing, as he waved everyone in with his other hand.
"No shoving, people!"
Ramsey circled wide around the group to get to the other side of the entrance and joined Rodriguez in trying to herd the crowd indoors as rapidly as possible. Another boom sounded behind him, and an instant later an immense pressure wave slammed into his body. He fell against a woman in front of him, and before he could react, a third explosion sounded to the west, its shockwave nearly knocking him off his feet. Ramsey turned just in time to see a telephone pole cartwheel end over end onto Highway 181, its transformer spewing sparks and small bursts of flames. The overhead lights that had illuminated the ER entrance and the hospital lobby went dark. The scene was pitched into near blackness, lit only by the terrible green glow descending from the sky. It took another few moments to get everyone inside, with Ramsey and Rodriguez coming through the now lifeless automatic doors last. Ramsey exchanged a glance with Rodriguez, and the anxious look he saw mirrored his sentiments exactly. He then surveyed the group in front of him. Nearly all of the people in the hallway were shouting, crying, or screaming. Ramsey had trouble making out details in the darkened corridor, but the faces of those closest to him, twisted by panic and illuminated only by the green glow from outside, looked ghastly. His mind flashed back to a trip he had taken to a haunted house during his senior year of high school. The fake werewolves, ghosts, and vampires hadn't scared him, but seeing his friends' faces snapshotted by black lights and strobes in the artificially generated fog had been frightening. The surreal scene before him now was similar to that. Slow motion horror played out on human canvases. For a moment, the visages of those closest to him, eyes wide with shock, mouths agape in terrified cries, weren't just reflecting the sickly green light, they were glowing with it. It took several more minutes to calm everyone down and get the group into the corridor that was designated as a tornado shelter. The facility's emergency lights clicked on after just a few minutes. They were dim compared to the hospital's normal lighting, but even their wan light was far better than the near-total darkness that had previously enveloped them. Every few seconds they heard a muffled thump as a meteorite impacted the ground. Each time the crowd ducked and stared up at the ceiling. Some of the impacts were so close that Ramsey could feel vibrations through the soles of his shoes. He instructed the group to stay put until the meteorite shower was over, and took Rodriguez back to the ER nurse's station. The staff members had gathered and were talking excitedly as he came around the corner, but fell into an expectant silence as he approached. Ramsey was the only on-shift doctor, and he realized that they would be looking to him for guidance. He thought quickly, and then began to rattle off instructions. He pointed to one of the LVNs and ordered, "Beth, call up to three. Have them start evacuating the entire floor as fast as they can. Then call every station on two and tell them to follow the tornado response plan. I want all patients and staff to move into the central corridors away from windows and exterior walls. Once you're done with the calls, get a couple orderlies and go up and help." The nurse turned back to her station and grabbed the phone, turning to the station receptionist, he issued more orders. "Try to reach the sheriff's office. I'm sure they already know what's going on out there, but ask them if they have any special instructions for us, and ask them if they're standing up the ERCC. The Emergency Response Command Center concept was adopted by the county several years ago in response to scathing after-action evaluations of the county's preparedness during episodes of severe regional flooding. The evaluation reports noted that communication between governmental departments and responders had been deplorable during the incidents, To correct this, a response plan was designed that called for a command center that would be staffed by members of the Sonrisa City Council, emergency responders, volunteer fire department, and sheriff's department. The ERCC would allow centralized command and control. Just as importantly, members of the ERCC would be able to collect and analyze information as a cohesive, mutually supportive group. Ramsey couldn't possibly imagine the county facing a worse crisis than the one unfolding outside. If the meteorites were now striking every few seconds, it was just a matter of time before houses or buildings began receiving direct hits. He couldn't begin to guess the resulting casualty count, but he feared it would be in the double or even triple digits. Emil, contact the on-calls along with everyone else. I want every available staff member to get here as soon as his stuff lets up. It can't last forever, and as soon as it's over, we are going to get swamped. Get Henry on the phone. He'll want to come in as well. Henry Whitaker was Conrad's administrator and the head of the board of directors. The hospital was his baby, and if there were tough decisions to make, Ramsey wanted Henry making them. Rodriguez gave his boss a nod and started around the station desk to get to a phone. He'd taken only a few steps before an explosion rocked the building. It felt as if a bomb had gone off above them. The hospital shook with the impact and sent the staffers ducking for cover as ceiling tiles and light fixtures crashed to the floor. Rodriguez shouted over the din,
"Shit, that sounded like the North Wing! This is like a war zone!"
It did feel like a war zone, like some hidden enemy had set up artillery guns and was bombing the hell out of Sonrisa.
"Emil, with me!"
Ramsey shouted. He didn't wait for a response, but sprinted for the stairwell connecting the central areas of the South Wing. Rodriguez caught up to him as he threw open the first fire door and ran up the stairs on the other side. Taking the stairs two at a time, they bolted to the third floor, crashed through another fire door, and sprinted down the central hallway. They reached the North Wing, pushed through the doors of the maternity ward, and were greeted by a huge cloud of dust that filled the hall and alcove containing the nurse's station. In the illumination of the flashing emergency lights, the dust took on an almost pale green hue.
That's not possible.
Ramsey shook the thought from his mind. It had to be his imagination. Shattered windows still sprinkled broken shards of glass. Wires from dislodged light fixtures dangled everywhere, swaying back and forth.
Maybe a bomb did go off here, Ramsey thought.
A nurse's aide sat on the floor behind the station desk amongst a pool of broken glass and debris, crying in pain and holding her leg. Her hair was matted with blood, and a large laceration ran lengthwise down her right shin. A nurse staggered down the hallway toward them, her face and hair covered in dust. Rodriguez broke left to head to the station desk, while Ramsey ran toward the nurse. As he reached her, he grabbed her by her elbows, and the woman looked up, finally seeing him. She was obviously in shock.
"Patients?"
Ramsey asked. She just stared up at him. He recognized her. Margarita, the shift RN for the ward. He shook her.
"Patients, Maggie, any patients? I need to know."
She at last seemed to hear the question. When she spoke, she shouted, and Ramsey realized that she had been deafened by the impact.
"301B! Just her!"
She pointed toward a room on the right. Ramsey dashed for the room. Inside, he saw the woman sitting in her bed, her blanket pulled tightly under her chin as tears streaked down her face. She looked at him and let out a cry of alarm. Ramsey held out his hands in a soothing gesture.
"It's okay. Everything's going to be fine. I'm Dr. Claiborne."
The woman's hands shook as she stared at him. Ramsey moved to the side of the bed, checked her monitors, and grabbed her chart.
"You doing okay?"
He tried to force calmness into his voice and suppressed a grimace as he realized what an idiotic question it was. Glancing at her chart in the dim emergency lights, he saw that her name was Maria Ortiz, age 28, sporadic labor contractions, slight cervical dilation.
Holy shit, this woman will be in full-blown labor tonight, tomorrow morning at the latest.
"My baby!"
The woman suddenly shrieked, dropping her hands to hold her huge stomach protectively. Her eyes were pleading, her forehead was covered in sweat. Ramsey moved to the far side of her bed, disengaged her monitors, and released the bed's brakes.
"Okay, Maria, the baby's fine. Step one is to get you out of harm's way, okay? Let's get you to another room, and we'll get ready for that sweet little baby."
The woman nodded jerkily, clutching the wad of covers in front of her chest as Ramsey wheeled her bed out of the room. In moments, they were in the main corridor, heading for the exit. Rodriguez came around the corner of the station desk with the aide's arm over his shoulder.
Maggie ran out. I'm not sure where she's going,
he said as he reached Ramsey's side. The aide, leaning on Rodriguez, was moving slowly, moaning with each step. Ramsey glanced over his shoulder at the debris-strewn corridor, relieved that despite the damage to the wing, he didn't see any signs of a fire. He slowed his pace to allow Rodriguez to keep up. The woman leaning on his shoulder clenched her teeth as she walked, sweat pouring off her face with the effort. Her right leg and shoe were drenched in blood, and Ramsey saw that she was leaving a wet, red trail behind her.
Maggie's in shock. Hopefully she'll show up later once she calms down. I don't think she was injured beyond some temporary hearing loss.
Ramsey glanced down at the woman in the bed.
We're going to need her very soon.
Yeah, agreed. I'll send someone to look for her if she doesn't show up soon, Rodriguez said. And Adele here is going to need some stitches for her leg. Not sure why she had to go and kick her desk so hard.
Shove off, Emil,
the woman growled through her gritted teeth before giving him a reluctant, pain-filled smirk. Ramsey shook his head in amazement. The aide was clearly in severe pain, yet Rodriguez had gotten her to smile. The man was an absolute pro.
What the hell is going on out there anyway?
She asked. The men exchanged an uncertain look, and Rodriguez's face turned sober.
Not sure, Adele. Something not good.
Ramsey moved the conversation back to short-term objectives.
We've got to concentrate on getting everyone off of three, out of danger, and then make our way to the ER. We're going to have a lot of company very soon.
The meteorite shower had lasted over 10 minutes already, and Ramsey was starting to wonder if it would ever end. Rodriguez grimaced.
Think it'll be bad?
Hope not, but hell, look at this place. Can you imagine what'll happen if the grocery store gets hit, or Ned's saloon?
It was Thursday night, and Ned's would be crowded. Rodriguez shook his head.
Dios mío, can you imagine what's going on in San Antonio right now?
Ramsey froze. Catherine. Jonathan. God, what if the meteorites are hitting there, too? Sonrisa was so spread out that the majority of the rocks would strike mesquite trees and farmers' fields, but what would happen in the densely populated city? Ramsey couldn't begin to imagine the devastation. It's about 9:30. Where did Catherine say she was? At home? Is Jonathan home, too? A pair of orderlies ran up to them as they reached the hospital's central hub. Conrad was built like a three-story boomerang, with a small central hub and wings that angled to the north and south. The central hub contained waiting and vending areas, as well as access to the elevators and staircases. Ramsey left Maria with one of the orderlies and instructed the other to give Rodriguez a hand with Adele. He instructed Rodriguez to get downstairs as quickly as possible in order to call the fire department and let them know that the hospital had sustained a direct hit.
We'll need to get someone here stat to assess the damage and determine if the hospital has to be evacuated. In the meantime, I'll go take a look at the damage myself.
Rodriguez suddenly looked concerned.
Want me to go with you?
Ramsey clapped him on the shoulder and answered,
Just get everyone downstairs. I'll be there in a minute.
Ramsey then headed into the now-abandoned maternity ward. The central corridor was so filled with dust that he couldn't see the end of it, and it was eerily quiet. He glanced down at the trail of blood left behind by the aide's wound. The crimson, flashing emergency lights animated the long, wet smear and made the blood appear to quiver and squirm on the floor. Glass crunched under his heels as he passed Maria Ortiz's former room and sidestepped a light fixture that dangled from its wires in the middle of the hallway. He reached into his pocket, pulled out his cell phone, and held it in front of him, using its meager illumination to see where he was walking. He reached the end of the hallway and glanced toward the last room. The door was intact, but when he tried to open it, he felt something blocking it from inside. He pushed hard, and the door relented. Glancing in, he stared at the damage. There was a gaping hole in the room's ceiling, with another through one of the exterior walls. The tiled concrete floor was fractured so badly that Ramsey was afraid to step into the room. The meteorite had apparently crashed into the room, struck the floor between beds A and B, then rebounded, smashing through the exterior wall next to the window. The ceiling was a jagged maw of sheared-off metal through which Ramsey could see the continued bombardment of green-tailed meteorites in the night sky. He saw bright flashes in the distance, wherever they smashed into the ground, and felt, as much as he heard, the dull thumps that followed each impact. He stared at the scene for a moment, and then made his way gingerly toward the window. He moved carefully, keeping as close to the exterior wall as possible to stay away from the compromised floor. Reaching the jagged opening that once held the window, he looked outside and caught his breath. There was a short gouge in the lawn below that ended in a small depression. A green fog filled the hole and slithered over the lawn, searching the turf like a mass of ethereal fingers. In the center of the hole, a football-sized rock still glowed from its descent through the atmosphere. It looked like a malevolent red eye staring up at him from a shattered earthen socket. A chill ran down his spine as he stared, transfixed by the otherworldly invader. When his cell phone rang, it startled him so badly that he jolted. He glanced at the display and quickly tapped talk.
"Kath, thank God."
There was no answer. An instant later, the display read, "Call lost." Chapter 3. Mikhail Leskov, Pyotr Sion. Mirny Station, Antarctica. 66 degrees, 33 minutes south, 93 degrees, 1 minute east. Captain First Class Mikhail Leskov turned in his black swivel chair to check the monitor once more. He was sitting next to his communications officer in the station's command center, Building 17. The aging structure housed the installation's armory, a blatant violation of the Antarctic Treaty of 1961, as well as the commander's quarters and library, a supply room, and a communications center. The latter was equipped with radio, cellular, and satellite-based communication systems. It also had a Soviet-era security system, a bank of 8 antiquated surveillance monitors mounted on a wall over the communication officer's station. The rightmost monitor, which cycled between several cameras at 4-second intervals, was bathed in static each time it switched to a display of camera 23. That meant that Pyotr Sion, his chief engineer, hadn't been able to fix the damn camera either. Earlier that morning, Mikhail, Misha, to the very few who could be called his friends, had driven his beloved Ford F-250 pickup to the diesel depot where camera 23 was mounted to the side of a weather observation tower. The trip took over an hour, even though the depot was only a few hundred meters away. Mirny had been hit with a localized snowstorm the night before, and 50-knot katabatic winds coming down from the interior had pushed the white shit into great heaps that were scattered all over the place. It had taken several servicemen and a pair of snowplow-mounted Kamaz dump trucks to clear a path. When he finally reached the depot, Misha climbed up the tower and inspected the camera, only to find nothing wrong with the damned thing. The fact that he hadn't been able to repair the camera frustrated him immensely. Misha tended the installation with a level of fanatical meticulousness that would have impressed a Japanese gardener. As well he should. After 2 decades, he was as much a part of Mirny Station as it was of him. He could remember the Cold War silliness that had dominated his day-to-day routine during his initial visits in the 1980s. He had even watched the Berlin Wall crumble from the station's communications room via live satellite uplink. It was in that same room where he had also received the news of the deaths of his wife and his daughter, Galina. They had been returning from Galina's audition. She had a beautiful soprano voice and dreamed of singing on Broadway. Their car was struck from behind by a sleepy Navy yard worker and burst into flames. That was in 1993. On occasion, Misha woke up drenched in sweat, the fading echoes of his girl's screams filling the dark void of his mind, before he pushed away the nightmare of their fiery deaths. After the accident, Misha knew there was no going back to Russia. He told anyone who dared to ask that he had become entranced with the beauty and dangers of Antarctica on his first trip when he arrived for training exercises as a young naval officer in 1982. The reality was that he was afraid to go back to the neighborhood, the city, or even the continent where his girls, his whole world, had lived and died. The thought of returning still made his hands shake uncontrollably. Some ghosts were too strong. Some tragedies were so unfair, so unjust, so unexpected, that they couldn't withstand the scrutiny of sober thinking. Events that horrible couldn't happen, so he had to ignore them, shut them out. Mirny was his life now, his duty, and he had no desire to be anywhere else, and that damn camera was going to get fixed today. Misha tried the old-timer's approach to technical problems and smacked the side of the offending monitor with his beefy fist. That didn't help, so he pushed himself up from his chair, causing the ancient thing to creak as loudly as his knees. Now 57 years old, he sported a thick gray beard beneath his round face, but he still retained much of the vigor of his youth. His back was straight, and his big, round shoulders were strong and proud. His damn knees, though. The traitorous things got worse and worse each winter as his arthritis progressed. Misha turned and strode out of the room, ignoring the smirking comm officer, and returned to his quarters on the first floor to don his cumbersome winter gear. Most of his possessions were standard military issue. His black gloves matched his jet-black overcoat, which bore the shoulder boards and triple golden stars of a captain first class. Rubberized black boots and a navy-issue wool hat completed his cold-weather uniform. The fuchsia-colored scarf that he wrapped around his neck, however, was distinctively non-regulation. Little Galina had knit it for him as a birthday present when she was 11. She presented it to him, explaining that his boss on the boat should let him wear it to keep him warm when the wind blew. He promised her that he would ask the captain and agreed that his boss should allow it, especially because it was made by the prettiest girl in all the world. Gal had squealed and giggled happily as Misha swept her up into a big hug. The scarf was the only part of his past that he kept with him, the only physical reminder he allowed himself. He knew that the audaciously colored scarf was a complete mismatch with his immaculate uniform, and that the science team interns laughed about it behind his back. He didn't care. He was still the old bear. And when he roared, which was often, those little sheep ran from the notoriously cranky station commander as fast as they could. Misha smiled at the thought as he pushed his knit hat down over his ears. It was nearing 10 o'clock, but the temperature outside was close to -20°C. He had lost the tip of his right index finger to frostbite several years ago and didn't want to take any risks with the remainder of his extremities. Passing down the corridor outside his quarters, he grabbed a satellite phone from its charging cradle and pushed through a cipher-locked door. From the first floor of the building, he had to descend a flight of metal stairs to get to the ground. Most of Mirny's buildings were built 2 to 3 meters off the ground in order to prevent them from being hopelessly buried during snowstorms. In fact, the original Stansaya Mirny, the more modern facility's predecessor, now lay buried under 2 meters of ice, a testament to the mercilessness of Antarctica's slow but inevitable reclamation of her sovereignty. The majestic continent would someday have her way and erase all trace of the interlopers. Whenever he reflected on it, a part of him was glad. The continent didn't want mankind there. He had experienced things that thoroughly convinced him of that fact. Blinding snowstorms that could dump 2 meters of snow overnight. Whiteouts. Temperatures well below -40. Katabatic gusts that exceeded Category 3 hurricane wind velocities. These were the more tangible ways that she showed her hostility. But there were things less tangible, especially at night. Sounds that went beyond the normal creaks and groans of the surrounding pack ice, and sounds that the scientists couldn't explain. Sometimes it seemed as though the continent was trying to scare the humans away. The Mirny staffers weren't going anywhere, though. The Soviet Union and then Russia had spent too much money on Mirny's facilities. More importantly, the scientific studies performed there had led to important meteorological discoveries. Even Misha begrudgingly admitted that. Mirny grew into one of the largest stations on the continent over the decades and was the hub of Russia's scientific presence there. The station's 30-odd buildings, built on the edge of the Davis Sea, were grouped into 3 locations, with several outlying buildings tossed hither and yon, just to make day-to-day life more difficult, Misha figured. The westernmost group of structures, the Diesel Depot, contained nearly all of their power generation equipment. 2 storage tanks with the capacity to store tens of thousands of liters of diesel fuel, which many years ago fed the voracious appetite of the Russian diesel-electric whaling fleet, sat near the edge of the 30-meter ice cliff that led to the Davis Sea. A pair of generator buildings, each with 2 massive diesel-powered electric generators, supplied an ample and safely redundant power supply to the entire base via underground cables. sheet metal sheds, used to store tools and workspaces, set nearby to accommodate repair work. One even contained a machine shop, which allowed the base members to forge new machine parts if the need arose. Several hundred meters east of the depot lay the spalnia, or bedroom, as everyone called it. It consisted of four rectangular buildings, arrayed more or less side by side. Each was about 40 meters long and contained two or three stories of living space, kitchens, baths, waste processing facilities, recreation rooms, libraries, and exercise rooms. Residence 3, which still sported a huge fading CCCP on its metal roof, also contained a fairly well-stocked bar, complete with a working American jukebox. Residence 1, the dormitory for the station support staff, contained a medical and dental clinic, as well as a small arboretum and chapel. The latter was sparse and seldom used, since the station had no resident priest. Several outbuildings, large recycling containers, and a snow smelter, which provided the base with fresh water, were scattered around the larger structures. Behind the spalnia, a large, hangar-shaped building that stored the station's vehicles hunkered against a rocky outcrop. Furthest east along the coast was a group of 14 offices, labs, and storage facilities that formed the scientific hub of the station. Misha thought of it as an adult daycare of sorts. It kept the arrogant scientists and their annoying assistants busy during the day and out of the way of his base support staff. During the Antarctic winter, from April to early October, this part of the base was used very little, but it was nearly November, and the typical mob of 200 or so self-righteous egotists had flown south for the summer and was already roosting in his base.
Asses,
Misha thought, as he descended the last of the rubber-coated stairs.
Every one of them.
Misha reached the frozen ground and turned toward his truck. His command center building was located amongst the science buildings, and he needed to find Pyotr Sion at the vehicle depot before the mechanical electrician packed up his tools for the day and ran to his room to hop back in bed with his girlfriend. Her name was Maria, a thin, bookish woman who had come down the previous summer to study meteorites. Sion, who was nearly as old as Misha, had done well for himself, Misha thought, although he also felt that Maria was out of his league. Still, Sion was his de facto second-in-command, a good man to have around and his closest friend. If he thought he had found the woman of his dreams, so be it. Sliding into the Ford's cab, Misha started the motor and reached for the radio.
Sion, where the hell are you, you great ass?
He barked into the handset. After a moment with no response, the engineer's hesitant voice came over the radio.
Yes. Yes, Misha, what is it?
No matter the topic, his speech was always a slow, unconcerned drawl. Misha could tell him that the station was under attack by aliens, and the man would reply,
Yes, yes, Misha, I'll see to it tomorrow.
He suppressed a smile at Cyan's wariness.
Let's go back and look at that camera again. There's got to be something going on that we both missed.
There was a sucking sound on the other end, and Misha knew the engineer was taking a drag of one of his foul cigarettes. Sion eventually responded,
I pulled the damn camera down, took it apart, and put it back together again. I'm telling you, there's nothing wrong on that end. It's in the cabling, or perhaps the comm center somewhere.
His voice was almost suppliant. Misha could imagine what Sion was thinking.
Oh, please, Misha, don't make me go freeze my balls off again. I'm bound to need them sooner or later. That camera's so old, Marshal Zhukov probably used it to keep tabs on one of his whores during the Great Patriotic War. It has to be the hardware.
It's not. Trust me on this, Sion said.
Sion and Misha had been through this routine 1,000 times during the engineer's years at Mirny. He was the only member of the station who was unafraid of the old bear's short-lived tantrums and who saw through his gruff exterior. He was the only staffer who really understood him. Misha knew this, and Sion knew this, and each knew that the other knew, but neither of them mentioned it. The result was a comradeship closer than either man would admit. Grumbling under his breath, Misha pushed the Ford into gear and turned down the hastily plowed path toward the vehicle depot. Lennon Street, as it had come to be known, was nothing more than a time-worn set of ruts in the ice. It connected the science labs, the residence buildings of the Spalnia, and the diesel depot.
Fine, he barked into the handset. I'm going to go get the camera and bring it back to the comm center. We'll take a look and try to route it directly into a monitor to see if the problem truly is in the cabling.
Yes, Misha, Cyan drawled. That sounds okay. I'll be by around noon to give you a hand.
Which means that he'll saunter in around 4, Misha thought.
Cyan added,
I'll bring some of your favorite roasted duck from the mess hall.
Misha spat out a particularly unsavory curse in Russian, realized he was still broadcasting, and let go of the transmit button to curse again. He heard Cyan burst into laughter on the other end of the radio. The station had received a large shipment of frozen ducks the previous summer. They were a big hit, but some had gone bad during transit, and the kitchen staff hadn't noticed. Misha and several others spent a week in bed with food poisoning. Sicknesses were taken much more seriously at Mirny than they were on the mainland. Even though the station's clinic was well-stocked, their degree of isolation meant that even relatively minor illnesses like infections and food poisoning could become life-threatening. The sick had been watched carefully day and night, and all had fully recovered by the end of the week. Still, the mere mention of that accursed duck still made Misha's stomach turn. Cyan made sure to bring it up every now and then, apparently for his own sadistic enjoyment. Speeding past the vehicle depot on his way to the diesel tanks, Misha flipped a finger toward the building on the off chance that Cyan was looking out a window. He was, and laughed even harder as he watched his boss rumbling past in his big American pickup. Mirny had a dearth of entertainment options to occupy his time with, and roughing up the old bear's fur was one of his few remaining pleasures. Cyan came to the station nearly 8 years ago as a volunteer, and he was sure Mikhail Leskov had seen him as an oddity. He wasn't military, not in the least. His tall, gangly body and shoulder-length hair were testaments to that. He wasn't a scientist, or even an academic, though to some he looked the part when he wore his small, round spectacles on his beak-like nose. Despite his advanced electrical engineering degree and an IQ that ranked him as one of the smartest people on the continent, let alone at the station, Cyan could be more accurately described as a hippie. This was due in no small part to his relaxed swagger and accompanying unkempt but not dirty style of dress. His outlook on life matched his outward appearance. Few things worried Cyan. He rode the flow of life wherever it felt like taking him. He had no demons in his closet like those he knew his boss faced. If he hadn't returned to Russia in almost 8 years, it meant that he hadn't felt the inclination to do so. When he did, and Cyan had no doubt that day would come, he would hop on the next outbound ship, and that would be that. Until then, he was content to hang out on the edge of the world's least hospitable continent, helping the base support team maintain the aging equipment that they were forced to rely on. How Maria Romanova factored into things, though, he could only guess. Cyan saw life as a linear set of events. Some opened doorways, portals to other pathways that were dotted with periodic, diverging episodes that led to still more possible pathways. The overall picture resembled the branching lines in the palms of his hands, one line flowing into another, branching off again, only to merge with others. Before meeting Maria, he said that he didn't care which pathway he ended up on, and that no one should care. Any belief that one could consciously change paths was an illusion fueled by a desire to self-govern. Life itself was an unstoppable river, and most people worried way too much about things that they couldn't control or even influence. Maria wasn't going to stay forever, though. She had already indicated that she would leave Mirny at the end of the summer scientific season. Cyan found himself considering whether to pursue the woman that he had undeniable feelings for, or stay at Mirny and follow his life's doctrine. He wasn't sure which he would ultimately decide, but he knew that whatever Maria represented in his life, he didn't want it to depart. He had this revelation during a meteorite hunting expedition the previous summer. A couple of months after her arrival, Maria had asked him to join her on a snowmobile excursion toward the distant Vostok station, to get off the base and to experience something more adventurous than his daily routine at the station. He agreed. Cyan and Maria were accompanied by a pair of assistants traveling on a second snowmobile. 7 hours out, they crested a rise and found themselves barreling toward a pressure fissure in the ice. Cyan gunned the motor and cleared the 2-meter gap, but the vehicle caught the edge of the crevice and cartwheeled, sending Maria flying. Cyan had managed to hold on, but bore the brunt of the machine's impact on his lower back and right leg. He was knocked unconscious and suffered cracked ribs, a bruised kidney, a nasty concussion, and a fractured femur. The expedition's only radio was on Cyan's vehicle, and it was irreparably smashed, so the assistants took a GPS reading of their position and raced off to get help. While Cyan was unconscious, Maria set up a field tent and somehow got him into it. She rolled him into a heavy wool emergency blanket and started a chemical burner unit to warm the interior. Confused and in severe pain, he faded in and out of consciousness as she tended him. Later that night, he awoke again to find Maria floating over him, her reddish hair framing the light features of her face like antique mahogany. They didn't speak, but stared into each other's eyes for several minutes. Time had stopped, and he simply existed. Their eyes spoke in the language of silence, and whatever understanding their spirits came to was a mystery to him. She broke the trance by reaching up to slowly stroke his hair, a gesture that seemed, if it was even possible, both intense and intimately tender all at once. He wanted to hold her hand against his face, but was unable to move, so he watched in silence as she warmed broth from their emergency kit, fed it to him, and then carefully checked the bandages that covered most of his leg. Those minutes in a tent in nowhere Antarctica forever changed him and transformed the way he saw Maria. Their spirits had exchanged an unspoken vow, he realized later, and were now bound to one another. Neither he nor Maria ever spoke of it, and yet each time they looked at each other, their gazes lingered, and they each saw understanding in the other's eyes. It was something that they could not grasp or control, perplexing, worrying, and exciting all at once. It made Cyan's head hurt to contemplate for too long. Misha showed up the following morning with a rescue party, the station's doctor, a Kamaz dump truck, and a trailer carrying a bulldozer. He had brought everything needed to pick up both the broken staff member and the wrecked snowmobile, he grumbled, explaining that he wasn't about to make a second trip for an overly reckless engineered. It had taken several months to repair, but eventually Cyan had the snowmobile functional again and had even given it a fresh paint job. When it was ready, he invited the station commander and all the staffers to an unveiling ceremony. The occasion, held in the vehicle barn, had been made even more festive by a couple of kegs of American beer received in trade from McMurdo, the large U.S. Antarctic headquarters base. The machine sat in the middle of the floor with a heavy tarp draped over it throughout the party. When the time came to unveil it, Cyan ceremoniously presented its keys to the commander and whisked the tarp off to reveal a lovingly restored vehicle, sporting a gaudy coat of fuchsia-colored paint. When Misha saw that it matched the color of his scarf, he raged so loudly that Cyan thought he would burst a blood vessel. The commander threw his hands in the air, shouted curses like only a Russian Navy man could, and even kicked the snowmobile. The crowd roared with laughter and applauded as the old bear stormed out of the building, commanding Cyan to repaint the vehicle before the day was out. At first, Maria had stared at the fuchsia vehicle, covering her mouth with her hand to hide her laughter. Later, however, when Cyan glanced at her from across the room, he caught a look of sober concern on her face. She made her way over to him, took him aside, and asked him if it had been wise to make the old bear so upset.
"He's transferred people off his base for less reason than that, Sayi."
She had used her pet name for him to lighten the scold in her tone, but he heard anger mixed with concern all the same. That puzzled him at first, but then it dawned on him that she was worried about losing him. The realization stunned him, and his reaction to it was equally as astonishing. Gladness, joy, relief. He had wondered what would happen with Maria in the months following the incident, but although they spent a lot of time together, their relationship hadn't gone beyond that of an intimate friendship. There seemed to be an odd, forced neutrality between them,
While their eyes continued their silent negotiations, he wondered what she truly felt for him, and had sat up many nights contemplating what he, in turn, felt for her. At that moment in the vehicle barn, though, months of wonder and worry crystallized into the knowledge that they were in love. When he suddenly tried to kiss her, she balked. She put her hands on his chest and pushed him back.
"What are you doing?"
she asked, shocked. The huge grin on his face had to look silly, but he didn't care.
"I love you too," he said.
They stared at each other for a few moments before Maria's hands slowly fell away, and Cyan pulled her into his arms for a long embrace. When they parted, Maria's expression was that of resolution.
"You need to talk to the old bear," she said.
Cyan nodded without taking his gaze from her, and when he bent once more to try to kiss her, she accepted it. That evening he would find out the story behind the scarf that he had so foolishly mocked. He waited until 5 o'clock before driving to Building 17 to visit his boss and make amends. When he knocked on the door of the commander's quarters, Misha barked,
"Come, Cyan."
The old bear had been expecting him. He heard a slur in his boss's voice.
"If he's drunk, this could be very bad."
If Cyan hadn't been an atheist, he would have said a prayer and crossed himself like he'd seen the Orthodox Catholics do. The heavy wooden door sported an aged placard that read, "Station Commander's Office. Authorized personnel only. Unauthorized entry will be prosecuted." Cyan shook his head as he read it. The old bear liked that sign. It fit his life's motif. No one got too close. No one breached the portal to his soul. There were no authorized personnel. Not anymore. He took a deep breath and opened the door. The station commander's compact quarters were laid out with military efficiency, and the old bear maintained them with Navy fastidiousness.
"Does he think a base inspection team will show up and count the dust specks on the desk? Mirny hasn't had an inspection team since the 1980s.
When he entered, the only light in the quarters emanated from a desk lamp in an adjoining study. Misha sat at his dining table next to a kitchenette. He closed the door behind him as Misha silently motioned for him to sit in the chair opposite his own. The only items adorning the table were a crystal decanter and two glasses. Misha slowly filled the second glass with vodka and slid it toward his chief engineer. Cyan saw the redness of the commander's cheeks and nose, and the bloodshot eyes let him know that the man had been hitting the vodka hard.
"Misha, I..."
"Shut up and drink with me, you ass," Misha said.
Cyan obediently downed his portion of the vodka. It was first-class stuff, smooth and warm, and it filled his belly with instant fire. Misha refilled Cyan's glass 4 more times as he told the story of Galina's scarf and of Galina's death. Cyan's heart sank as he listened, and his horror at his actions grew more and more tangible. Tears filled his eyes as he realized what he must have put his commander through in the vehicle barn.
"My God, Misha, I would never have... I'm so sorry. I really am an ass."
Misha stared at him for a long moment and then nodded,
"Yes. Yes, you are."
Cyan held his breath, waiting for his commander to pronounce his punishment. Then, for the first time since arriving at the station, Cyan saw him laugh. The despairing, bitter laugh that poured out at first eventually turned into a belly-shaking outburst. Cyan found himself laughing along with him, wondering what the hell was so funny. Misha laughed until tears flowed down his red cheeks. Shaking his head, he finally got a hold of himself and wiped the wetness from his eyes. He refilled both glasses, emptied his own in a single gulp, and slammed it down. He stood, and as he walked around the table, he put a hand on Cyan's shoulder. His smile was suddenly tinged with sadness, along with something else that Cyan couldn't identify.
"I take life too seriously. This I know. Just as I know that you are too flippant about it."
His smile faded as he stared down at Cyan.
"Today was the first time that I faced my past and felt anything other than pain. I wasn't as entertained at your little jape as you were, but despite my outburst in the vehicle barn, I found what you did amusing and enlightening."
Misha glanced at the hot pink scarf that hung on a peg next to his coat locker. His eyes lingered there for a moment. and then he looked back at his second-in-command.
My gal is gone, but today proves to me that she lives on. I know you don't believe in such things, but I do. If she didn't, things like your painting of that damned machine the same color as her scarf wouldn't happen. You probably don't understand what I'm saying with that logical mind of yours, but so be it. I know what I'm saying is true. So let's say a toast to her, wherever she is, and carry on with life. And for Christ's sake, don't repaint the vehicle. Keep it Galina's color.
They raised their glasses several times as they listened to Rachmaninoff, Glazunov, and Glier on the boss's record player. Sion hadn't known that Misha shared his love of Romantic-era Russian composers, and it turned out that the old bear had an incredible collection of lovingly cared-for vinyls. Sion told Misha of his revelation regarding Maria, and the commander gave him his own brand of sage advice.
She's a good woman, so don't fuck it up.
Coming from Misha, the statement sounded like a fatherly blessing, and it meant a lot to Sion. Grinning widely, he held up his glass for another toast.
To my love life, may I not fuck this up?
Misha roared with laughter, and Sion laughed so hard that he spilled more vodka than he drank, which made both men laugh even harder. That had been the night the two men cemented their friendship, and, to Sion, it felt deeply satisfying. It was also gratifying to realize he had accidentally brought some healing to the grumpy station commander. When he shared the experience with Maria that night in her quarters, she burst into tears of relief and enveloped him in an intense hug.
"I'm so proud of you, Sai,"
she whispered as she reached up to stroke his cheek. They held each other for a long time, and Sion had never felt so content. Now, watching the station commander's truck race toward the depot, Sion reflected on how incredible the last few months of his life had been. He and Maria had spent much of their time together, and he experienced an emotional intimacy with her that he never dreamed possible. He regretted living such a lonely lifestyle until that year. What he had thought of as independence had really just been a waste. Sion grabbed his parka and slipped it on before heading into the freezing cold and back to the Spalnia. Maria would be there, waiting for him to give her a ride to the building that housed the base's new equipment for classifying and storing meteorites. Russia was the first nation to invest in a high-tech meteorite clean lab on the continent. Maria was the facility's meteorite curator and one of Russia's foremost scientists in the field of meteorite studies. As such, Antarctica was her dream assignment. On the pack ice, it was orders of magnitude easier to locate meteorites, and the sub-zero temperatures kept the samples preserved and free of biological contaminants. With a clean lab at Mirny, Maria was able to perform her analysis on the rocks only hours after locating them, whereas the Americans collected the samples, packed them in dry ice, and shipped them to their Antarctic Meteorite Processing Laboratory at NASA's Johnson Space Center. Sion hopped into one of the station's utility trucks and drove to the Residence One building. Maria came down as soon as she saw him pull up. Sion smiled as he watched her waddle around the truck in her heavy parka. She climbed onto the passenger seat and leaned over to give him a kiss on the cheek.
"Late," she said, giving him a warm smile. "Thanks for the lift, love."
He gave her thigh a squeeze as he turned the truck around and started toward the science buildings.
"Sorry. Misha had me up at the depot checking on a damn camera. Useless things. He's afraid someone will sail up and steal our diesel?"
Maria asked, amused.
"Oh, you know the old bear. He's got nothing better to do."
After the snowmobile incident, Maria, too, had become close friends with the station commander. There were many nights when the three of them played cards or watched a recorded football game in the commander's quarters as they drank whiskey or vodka and relaxed. Misha also adjudicated the couple's early arguments and somehow always declared that Sion was in the wrong. Maria, Sion knew, found the older man affable underneath his gruff exterior, and Misha quickly became a father figure to her. At 39, she was much younger than Misha, and he doted over her as if she were some long-lost granddaughter. Each time she went on a meteorite expedition, for example, Misha assigned no fewer than four assistants to go with her, ostensibly to help her with the manual labor, but she knew that he was actually assigning guardians to watch over her. Each man had a wireless radio, and their vehicles were double-checked before each expedition, per the old bear's orders. Maria adored the doting, and Cyan thought it was good medicine for Misha's emotional scars.
"Well, it's only 10:15, you're not that..."
Cyan leaned forward in his seat to look up into the twilight sky.
"What do you make of that?"
Maria glanced at him, and then followed his eyes skyward. Brilliant lances of green light streaked in the heavens as meteorites sliced through the atmosphere. In Antarctica, meteorite showers were common and were even more breathtaking in the clear skies than when viewed from one of Russia's cities. This, however, was like nothing either of them had ever seen. Cyan stopped the truck, and they jumped out to gain a better view. Maria walked around the front of the truck and grabbed Cyan's arm. As they watched, the sky filled with green streaks that fell farther and farther toward the ground as the minutes went by. One particularly bright one arced toward Earth and exploded into bits. Cyan pointed,
"That was only 2 miles above the ground!"
Maria turned as she scanned the sky in every direction.
"Sai, this isn't right!"
He keyed in on the worried tone in her voice.
"What do you mean?" "Well, beside the odd coloration, there is no radiant."
She pointed toward various points in the sky.
"They're coming from multiple directions all at once, sometimes even crisscrossing. That's not possible."
She gripped his arm tightly. Some of the meteorites were very near the Earth before disappearing in flashes of sickly, greenish light.
"What?"
When she didn't respond, he asked again.
"Maria, damn it! What are you talking about?"
Cyan rarely swore, and it caused Maria to break free from her trance. She looked at him, and he saw the alarm in her eyes.
"Every meteorite shower has a radiant, a point from which it appears to originate, at least to an observer on the ground. This storm is coming from everywhere at once. But that's not all. The major meteorite showers that hit Earth are all catalogued. Most originate from comets or minor planets, and we can calculate their cycles very accurately."
She paused as she returned her gaze to the sky.
"Sai, there aren't supposed to be any meteorite showers this month. The next one isn't supposed to occur for 3 months. This one is completely uncharted."
Cyan ducked reflexively as a muffled boom rolled over him. He jerked up again and turned toward the coast to see a huge plume of water climb skyward.
"My God! Let's go, we shouldn't be out here!"
Maria shouted. Maria dove for the truck's open driver's door as another detonation, this one even louder, erupted from somewhere off the coast. Before Cyan could get into the vehicle, pressure waves from nearby impacts rolled over him, rocking the truck back and forth. Maria turned and reached over the seat to pull him into the cab.
"Get in!"
Cyan jumped into the driver's seat, threw the truck in reverse, and stomped on the gas pedal. The vehicle skidded and slid backward as he jerked the wheel to whip the front end around. A huge blast rocked the truck and shoved it sideways off the worn ice road. They ducked, and Cyan instinctively threw an arm over Maria's shoulders. The explosion was deafening. He popped up and looked out the rear window just in time to see pieces of equipment and metal siding raining from the sky. One of the science buildings disintegrated before his eyes. He gunned the motor and raced back toward the residence buildings and away from the falling debris. The radio crackled to life.
"Cyan, are you seeing this? Get to the..."
It was Misha, and in a moment of sheer horror, Cyan remembered where the man was. 2 stories off the ground on the weather tower that overlooked the massive diesel storage tanks. He snatched up the radio and keyed the transmit button.
"Misha, get the hell out of there! Get away from the diesel tanks!"
There was no response. Cyan threw the truck into a sliding turn toward the diesel depot and hit the gas again. The tires spun for a moment before catching traction and launching the truck forward. Moments later, as they closed in on the depot, a huge ball of fire leapt into existence ahead of them. The truck was suddenly off the ground, thrown backward into the air. Cyan grabbed for Maria's hand an instant before the vehicle crashed end over end through ice and snow. His head smashed into the steering wheel with a blinding flash of pain, and when he opened his eyes, his vision was a bloody haze. Red snow cascaded into the inverted truck's shattered windshield. Maria's door was ajar, and over the staccato thumps of meteorite impacts, he heard the insistent, angry static of a dead radio. He was alone. Chapter 4 The Little Princess and the Giant. Green means life.
They're magic,
the little princess said. They had just left her palace, a grassy hill concealed by a clump of mesquite and southern live oak trees near the river, when they first noticed the green meteorites. Her hazel eyes gazed skyward, so she couldn't see Carter's face, but she knew that her older brother wouldn't disagree. He never disagreed with anything she said, even though he was 7 years older than she was. He just followed her around like a big, dumb puppy, agreeing with anything she said. She wished he would disagree, at least every now and then, but she knew it would never happen. Mama said as much before she left.
You watch out for Carter, Princess. He minds what you tell him, and you know he don't think for himself.
Those had been her last words to Emmy. Mama had given her a peck on the cheek and turned to her friend, Jim.
Come on, baby, she said.
And they walked out. Jim slammed the metal trailer door behind him as they left, which banged like a parting gunshot, ending her life with Mama forever. She remembered thinking that Jim was far too old to be Mama's baby. That honor, she thought, had belonged to her alone. Emmy waited for her for a long time. Mama often dropped them off at Grandma's house whenever she needed to go somewhere with a friend. Sometimes Emmy was there for a few hours, sometimes a few days. Once, she and Carter stayed at Grandma's for 3 weeks. Mama returned with bruises on her face that time. She had been 7 years old when Mama left with Jim. Grandma said she was 10 now, although Emmy wasn't totally sure about that. Grandma provided food and clothing, using the money she got on her warfare check, but otherwise ignored them. Emmy never went to school like other kids did, so she spent most of her days reading picture books or playing by the river with Carter. As long as she did her chores and kept Carter out of trouble, that was fine by Grandma. Every now and then, when she was in a good mood, Grandma let them go with her into Sonrisa with their neighbor, Mr. Hodges. Sometimes they went to the park, and sometimes they stayed with Grandma as she did her shopping. Either way, it was always a grand adventure to Emmy. Those were some of her best memories. Her very bestest memory, though, was something her mind could barely touch. A vague image of Mama sitting on an old rocking chair, braiding Emmy's long black hair as she sat crisscross applesauce on the floor in front of her. Emmy could still walk back then, and dance, and run. The wheelchair didn't come until later. Mama had reached around, stroked her cheek, kissed the top of her head, and whispered something. No matter how hard she tried, all Emmy could remember were the words,
"My little princess."
One night, sitting on Grandma's front porch a few months after Mama left with Jim, Emmy asked Grandma if she really was a princess. Grandma's expression turned sour as she took a long drag on her cigarette. With sarcasm that even a 7-year-old could recognize, she said that, oh yes, she thought Emmy was a princess, and someday her Prince Charming would show up and she'd be getting hitched and living happily ever after and all of that shit. Grandma said lots of bad words. When Emmy asked her what hitched meant, she said it meant that a man would come and put a ring on her finger and take her places, and she would have her own house to live in. Emmy thought that would be really neat, and had asked Grandma how come she didn't have a man, even though she had a house and lots of rings on her fingers. Grandma didn't answer, but instead stormed off into the trailer, stomping on her half-smoked cigarette on the way in. Emmy didn't ask about getting hitched again. Emmy pointed upward as one particularly bright meteorite blazed through the sky and disappeared with a pretty greenish flash. She squeezed Carter's arm and smiled.
See? See how pretty, Carter?
She looked up at his big, chubby face.
Pretty. Yep. Pretty.
He smiled broadly. Emmy saw the wonder in his eyes. Carter never spoke much, and the words he used were usually a repeat of her own. Grandma once said that Carter was slow. When Emmy had asked what that meant, Grandma said,
"Slow, you know. Idiot. Retarded-like."
Emmy wasn't sure what retarded-like meant, but she got the idea. Carter's brain didn't work so good. That was okay by her. What she liked most about her brother was that he was huge. Not just fat. Gigantic. Carter had to stoop to get out of the front door of Grandma's trailer. and when he picked Emmy up from her wheelchair, his hands wrapped completely around her waist. Once, when Grandma dropped them off at the pizza place in town, some big boys began to pick on Emmy. There were three of them, and they waited for Carter to go to the restroom before sauntering over. The boy that seemed to be in charge walked up and stood next to her, trapping her in the booth Carter had sat her in. He wore a red flannel shirt and smelled like Grandma's seldom-emptied ashtrays. Emmy pretended not to see him as she stared down at her pizza, but her heart was pounding in her chest. The boy nudged her with his knee and asked her what her name was. She told him,
"Lemmy? That's your name, Lemmy? Let me see,"
sniggered another teenager, who slipped into the booth opposite her.
"Lemmy Emmy?"
the third kid, a Latin boy with a pockmarked face, asked as he too slipped into the booth. All three laughed, evidently at their own cleverness, and laughed even harder when Emmy started to cry. They took her plate of food away and knocked her soda glass over, spilling root beer all over the table. They called her names like Crip and Whore, and the Latin boy called her a pendeja. Emmy didn't know what that word meant, but it made her cry even more. Then the boys stared up in awe as Carter walked up to tower over them. When he saw that Emmy's cheeks were covered in tears, his face screwed up into a grimace of rage, the likes of which Emmy had never seen before.
You!
He growled at them as his eyes flicked back and forth between his sister's face and her tormentors. The teenagers laughed nervously, perhaps hoping that Carter wouldn't understand what was going on. Carter leaned over the table and grabbed the two seated boys by their heads. His massive hands covered their faces, and he lifted them out of the booth and flung them to the floor as easily as a child might throw a couple of toy soldiers. The grown-ups in the restaurant started shouting, and one of the boys started crying. The boy standing next to Emmy turned to flee, only to be collared by Carter, who spun him around in midair. Holding him a foot off the ground, he screamed into the boy's face,
You!
Before dropping him to the floor in a heap. The restaurant manager came out and started yelling at Carter, who immediately looked down at the floor and put his right hand on his head. Emmy had seen the gesture many times before, whenever Grandma got drunk and started yelling at him. It was his sign of submission. He would stand there with one hand on his head, looking down at his shoes until the tirade was over. When the manager continued shouting, however, Carter suddenly turned, picked up Emmy in one arm and her metal wheelchair in the other, and ran for the door.
Go!
He shouted as he shouldered his way through the door and ran, his great lumbering body pounding the ground so hard that each step made Emmy's teeth rattle. It took 8 blocks to get Carter settled down enough to stop running, with Emmy reassuring him over and over that everything was okay. He looked at her, and Emmy saw so much fear and uncertainty in his eyes that she started to cry. She gave him a peck on his baby-smooth cheek and grinned, her wet eyes glittering with sudden amusement.
"Those boys thought you were a giant. Did you see how afeared they were?"
Carter raised an eyebrow and broke into a huge grin.
"Big trouble."
He hooked a thumb to point at his chest, and they erupted in laughter. She giggled more and more as Carter's big body jiggled with laughter, causing her, in turn, to bounce around in his massive embrace. They laughed for so long that her sides hurt, but Carter eventually set her wheelchair down and gently placed her in it, whispering,
"Go, go, go! Go, go, go! Go, go, go!"
Emmy looked up at him and squeezed his hand. She had never been as proud of her brother, the giant, as she was on that day. That happened over a year ago, but now, staring up at the strange green meteorites blazing through the sky, she felt safe in her giant's presence. After a few minutes, the falling rocks began exploding with sounds that reminded her of the Pop Rocks candy that Grandma had occasionally bought for her. A tingling sense of doubt began to creep into Emmy's mind.
"Pick me up, Carter. Let's go show Grandma. Just leave my chair here so we can hurry."
He picked her up, but before he could start for home, they heard the loud crump of a meteorite hitting the ground and immediately felt the earth shake. When the second and third impacts shook the ground mere seconds later, even Carter seemed to sense danger.
"Duck cover! Duck cover!"
It was Carter's version of the saying, "duck and cover," a phrase that he picked up from one of his favorite cartoons.
"Get back to the house,"
Emmy said, clutching him tighter. Meteorites exploded above their heads in a rapid machine gun staccato, accented by the bass boom of those striking the ground all around them. In two loping strides, Carter was at a full sprint, thumping through the woods, plowing his way through the underbrush, muttering,
"Go now! Go now! Go now!"
in rhythm to his footfalls. The soggy ground and spindly trees were illuminated as if by a full moon that some prankster had painted glow-in-the-dark green. Emmy ducked as a barbed mesquite branch plucked at her hair.
"Be careful, Carter! The branches!"
she shouted as a second thorn-covered tree reached out for her face. They made it halfway to the trailer when an impact knocked Carter off his feet. Emmy looked away from an intense flash of light a split second before the ground lurched up at her.
"Oh!"
Carter exclaimed as he tumbled sideways, nearly crushing Emmy with his enormous bulk as she flew out of his arms. Shutting her eyes, she clutched uselessly at the wildly spinning ground until she slid to a stop. She tasted mud and leaves and something coppery. She sat up, wiping the back of her hand over her mouth. She had thankfully bounced and rolled much farther than her brother, or else he might have squashed her. Carter was on his hands and knees trying to get up.
"M.M.? M.M.?"
he asked, his brow furrowed with worry.
"I'm all right, I think,"
she said, looking over at him. Despite his enormity, Emmy had never felt afraid of her brother. She didn't exactly fear him now, but his features looked weirdly colored in the green light's illumination. His pale cheeks looked almost translucent. His ruddy, blonde hair took on the color of seaweed, and for an instant, his eyes glinted like twin green lights. Emmy felt goosey bumpies on her arms and looked away. Glancing down, she saw that her dress was covered in mud and wet, sticky leaves, and she saw a large tear down one side. Grandma wouldn't be pleased.
"Come get me. We gotta hurry."
Carter pushed himself up and plodded over to her. Picking her up, he turned and started running up the path once more. A few minutes later, they were behind the trailer. Carter came to a stop after bounding over the rickety barbed wire fence into the backyard. The carport containing Grandma's broken-down Chevy Impala, lawnmower, and other stuff had disappeared. Twisted metal and other pieces of debris were strewn all over the yard, and Emmy saw the blown-out shell of a propane tank lying on its side. Smoke billowed from the wreckage, and Emmy caught sight of the hood of the old Impala embedded into the side of the house. Grandma's trailer looked mostly intact, although it had been knocked sharply aside and had fallen off of most of its concrete blocks, causing the back to slant steeply downward. Most of the windows, including the sliding glass doors that led to the living room from the backyard, were shattered. Carter started forward, and Emmy directed him through the gaping hole where the patio doors had been. She wanted to call out for Grandma, but some instinct compelled her to stay quiet. The house was totally dark, save for the greenish glow seeping in through the broken windows, and the light emanating from Grandma's battery-operated Woody the Woodpecker alarm clock. The antique had somehow remained atop the island that separated the kitchen from the living room, although it was flipped upside down. Its illuminated eyes, which spooked Emmy whenever she got up in the middle of the night to go tinkle, faced downward, casting a feeble light over the debris of Grandma's shattered knick-knacks. Woody's perpetually laughing mouth emitted the crimson light of the electronic display. According to Woody, it was 9:23 p.m. The house was silent, the kind of utter silence that Emmy experienced only on the rare occasions when she was alone in the trailer. There was no sign of Grandma, and the continuing meteorite impacts seemed muffled and distant, as if the house's silence suppressed all sound from the outside world. Carter glanced from the clock to Emmy, and then turned to survey the wreckage of the trailer's interior. Dark shadows seemed to sway in the strange green light, and the disarray of the house's contents made the place look foreign to Emmy, alien and inhospitable. The indiscernible stillness of the house caught Emmy's heart in her throat. Nothing moved, and the scene before her felt dampened, like the air was being pressed by a heavy, invisible hand. Emmy heard her heartbeat and felt Carter's strained breathing through his sweaty shirt as he held her tightly against him. Carter started to slowly make his way up the incline of the sloping house, carefully stepping around overturned chairs, VHS tapes from the entertainment center, and the big brown living room couch, which had slid sideways and nearly blocked the hallway leading to Grandma's bedroom. He moved like a burglar, as if deathly afraid to make a sound. Squeezing past the misplaced couch, he stopped at the entrance to the hallway. Grandma's door was open, and the greenish light from her bedroom seemed to be crawling across the carpet into the darkened space in front of them, invading it with an unwanted presence. Emmy heard Carter's teeth chattering, and his body started to tremble as he stared at the unnatural light. Emmy tore her eyes away from the doorway and prodded him.
"We gotta go check on her,"
she whispered, sucking the words into her mouth rather than breathing them outward, in order to stay as quiet as possible. She was about to repeat herself when he lurched forward. He entered the hallway slowly, creeping toward the doorway, his free hand sliding along the wall for balance. Crunch. The sound was so loud in the quiet house that Emmy let out an involuntary squeak, and Carter grunted, "Oh!" so loudly that Emmy squeaked again. They looked down at the floor. Carter's huge boot covered a picture frame from Grandma's family picture wall. She couldn't see which one he had just stepped on, but she knew it had to be a photo of one of Grandma's three sons. They were the only people she displayed pictures of. Emmy and Carter looked at each other, and both let out a breath. Emmy would have laughed if she weren't so terrified. She knew that Carter was close to panic as well. Her breathing was rapid, and she felt her heart pounding in her chest, and wondered if this was how people in scary movies felt when they walked through spooky places. She shook the thought away, not wanting to reflect on what usually happened to them. Carter took three more cautious steps, and they peered into Grandma's room. Emmy saw that Grandma's queen-sized bed was tossed into the corner. The wooden crucifix with the letters INRI that should have been on the wall above her headboard was missing, and Grandma's eight-drawer dresser was toppled over. Emmy was just starting to wonder where Grandma was when she saw a pair of pasty feet on the floor, jutting out from the closet. Something told her that Grandma was dead before she asked Carter to check. He set Emmy down on the crooked dresser and walked over to the closet. As Carter picked Grandma up, her head lolled backward, and Emmy heard a squishy sound that made her tummy lurch. Grandma's head hung down unnaturally, facing Emmy. Her eyes were open and seemed to be staring at her. Emmy shivered and looked away quickly as Carter laid Grandma on her bed and covered her with a quilt. As they left her room, Carter tried to close the door, but the house was so crooked that the door no longer fit into the frame. He left it open, and they retreated down the hallway and into the dining room. Half an hour later, still sitting in the dark living room, Emmy tried to think of what to do. Carter sat sullenly on the floor opposite her, holding his knees to his big belly and rocking back and forth. They had no telephone and no immediate neighbors. The dirt road they lived on wound for several miles over the mesquite-covered hills southwest of Sonrisa, dead-ending at the steep bank of the San Antonio River. Grandma's house was near the end of the road, only a few minutes' walk from the water. Mr. Hodges lived several miles up the road in the other direction, and beyond his place, a few trailer homes dotted the road as it curved and turned down to Farm to Market 2569. FM 2569 itself was sparsely populated out where Emmy lived, but it eventually led to Sonrisa, about a 30-minute drive away.
"I guess in the morning we should go up to Hodges' house. He'll know what to do. And maybe he can call the police to come see after Grandma," she said.
Emmy sat on her pink wooden rocking chair, the one she always used while reading her picture books. At one time, the back of the chair was painted with an Easter scene of a big-eyed Peter Rabbit sitting on his hind legs, a pile of Easter eggs in front of him. Most of the paint had peeled off over the years, leaving Peter nearly headless and with only one arm, but she still remembered what he looked like. Emmy sat holding a floppy-eared stuffed kangaroo named Sam on her lap. Stroking Sam's head, she stared out through the shattered living room windows. Emmy struggled to drive the image of Grandma's body from her mind. She had looked pale in the strange light coming in through the bedroom window, the same way Carter looked when they were outside and the meteorites were falling. The similarity was creepy in a way that she couldn't understand, and she found herself looking over at her brother.
"He's okay. He has to be all right."
He was the only person left in her world. He could not leave her like Grandma and Mama had. Tears welled up in her eyes, but she blinked them away defiantly. She had gotten very good at holding back tears over the past few years.
I still think they're magic, just maybe not the kind of nice magic I thought they were.
Her voice was barely a whisper. She pulled Sam into a hug.
I was so sure. They were so pretty. And green is a good color. Grass, trees, avocados, grapes. Lots of green things are good things. Living things.
She stuck a finger into Sam's pouch and imagined a baby kangaroo in there.
Green means life, Sam.
Thump. The sound was so unexpected that it made her jolt upright in her chair. Her eyes darted toward the sound, toward Grandma's room. The sound reminded her of the noise Grandma made when she was walking in her room. In the flimsy trailer, Emmy could always hear people walking in the other rooms.
Maybe she's okay after all.
Her heart was racing again, though, as she thought,
she's dead. Her neck is broken. She isn't coming back, so who made that noise?
She looked over at Carter. He had stopped his rocking and was staring motionlessly toward the hallway that led to Grandma's bedroom.
He heard it, too. Probably something fell off of something else, owing to the house being so crooked,
she said, her voice a strained whisper. Carter tore his eyes away from the dark maw of the hallway and nodded jerkily.
I tell you what, let's go on up to Mr. Hodge's right now. No sense in waiting till the morning. You can find your way in the dark, right?
He nodded quickly, and Emmy saw relief wash over his features. He stood up as quickly as a person his size could manage and went over to Emmy's chair. Emmy glanced toward the hallway one more time, half expecting to see Grandma emerge in her nightgown.
Go now, M.M. Go now,
he whispered. For once, Emmy heard decisiveness in his tone. Carter picked her up and moved quickly to the front door. He had to jump from the trailer to the now-detached front porch a few feet away. Emmy bounced with the impact of a landing, but she was glad to be out of the house. He crossed the porch, took the stairs down to the front yard, and was striding away purposefully. Carter carrying Emmy, Emmy carrying Sam the kangaroo. She looked back toward the house as they neared the dirt road and, for the first time, saw the gaping hole in the ground in front of the decimated carport. She hadn't seen it from the backyard, but now realized that one of the meteorites had barely missed the house. A wispy, greenish fog was creeping out of the hole. It seemed to be glowing from within, pulsing and throbbing with a faint light.
Does green always mean life?
Carter turned left onto the rutted dirt road that led to Mr. Hodge's place. Emmy snuggled against him, regretting that she hadn't grabbed her sweater from the coat closet next to the front door. Carter, perhaps sensing that she was chilled, wrapped both huge arms around her. Despite the nip in the air and the calamities that had transpired that evening, it wasn't long before the rhythm of Carter's strides soothed her to sleep. She dreamed of Mama and Jim riding on the rusty old merry-go-round that Emmy liked to ride whenever Grandma dropped her off at the Sonrisa City Park. The park was dark and smelled of moldy pecans. Emmy walked toward Mama. In her dreams, she could always walk. She and Jim were giggling like carefree kids as the merry-go-round spun in lazy circles. Mama had a pretty yellow summer dress on, and her bare feet hung out over the ground as the ride went around and around. She was the prettiest sight Emmy had ever seen. Her heart soared as she started to run toward Mama.
She didn't leave me after all. She was only at the park.
As she got closer, Mama looked toward her, and Emmy saw her smile fade into a dead-eyed stare. Mama nudged Jim, who looked at Emmy and grew serious. Emmy stopped running and hid behind a tree, peeking out to stare at them. Jim stared back at her, while Mama refused to look her way at all. She was smoking a cigarette, like always, and as she took a puff, her face lit up in a rosy orange light. Jim gave Emmy an evil, broken-toothed smile. His face was small, hawkish. He kicked the ground to make the ride move faster, and then kicked it again, and then again, all the while staring at Emmy. Emmy started forward, convinced that he and Mama were going to get away from her. Jim kicked the ground one more time, and the ride leapt a few feet off the ground as it picked up speed. Mama turned to look at her, her eyes dull, her face impassive. Emmy broke into a run.
Mama, wait, Mama, I want to come too.
Jim kicked the ground over and over. His leg was impossibly long now, his foot enormous. The merry-go-round was spinning so fast that Mama was a blur.
No, please, Mama, he's lying to you. I'm your baby, not Jim. I'm your baby, Mama.
Emmy felt Jim's foot pounding on the ground as the ride skipped and hopped away from her. She ran and ran, trying futilely to catch the merry-go-round.
M.M.? M.M.?
Emmy's eyes fluttered open. A malicious orange glow surrounded them from the hilly underbrush on either side of the road. The smell of burning mesquite was oppressive, and clouds of white smoke swirled around them like tormented ghosts in the roiling air.
"Where are we?"
she asked, confused by her fitful dream. Emmy pulled herself upright in Carter's arms to look around, and a new horror gripped her. Fire surrounded the narrow dirt and gravel track that they had been following.
"We gotta get out of here. Are we close to Mr. Hodge's place?"
Carter looked around at the orange and red flames. He shook his head.
"How far? How much farther do you think it is?"
Again he shook his head. He kept looking back in the direction of Grandma's trailer, and Emmy could tell that he wanted to run back the way they had come. She glanced around, trying to remember the landmarks that would tell her how far they had gone, as well as how close they were to Mr. Hodge's house. Smoke, along with the insistent growl and crackle emanating from the flames, told her that she needed to act quickly. The flames were only 50 feet away, and she saw them advancing, jumping from tree branch to tree branch like red and yellow monkeys, transforming everything they touched into fire. Emmy chewed on her bottom lip, looking forward, then backward, and forward again. If they got surrounded, they would be in real trouble, but the closest grown-up lived directly in the path of the flames. She looked back. Only the shambles of Grandma's house and the dead end of the road near the bank of the river were behind them.
"Carter, go!"
Emmy tried to sound confident as she pointed down the road toward Mr. Hodge's house. Carter cocked his head to the side and raised one eyebrow, giving her a look of incredulity that, if their lives weren't in danger, would have made her burst into giggles.
"Trust me, Mr. Hodge's place is that way. That's the way to go."
Carter glanced up the road and then back at her.
"Go, go,"
he whispered slowly, the reluctance apparent in his voice. The fire had advanced another 10 feet in the few seconds it had taken to decide which way to go. Emmy squinted and covered her mouth with her hand as Carter plodded forward, one massive stride at a time, his head bowed, eyes staring at some invisible spot just ahead of his big white tennis shoes. Within moments they were lost in smoke so thick that she could barely make out the edges of the road. She saw tears streaking his smudgy face as they slid through the grime toward his chin. She fought back a smoke-induced cough and realized that he wasn't covering his mouth.
"You gotta cover your mouth,"
she whispered, choking out the words. Shifting Sam to her other hand, she picked up the hem of her dress and held it to his mouth.
"Like this."
She kept her dress there, held up to his mouth, and felt him breathing through it. There was something reassuring about the sensation. As long as he drew breath, he would be her protector. Carter kept walking toward safety, holding her in one huge, flabby arm as he plodded forward.
"Thank you,"
she whispered, and the little princess kissed her giant on his grimy cheek. He finally looked at her.
"Go now, M.M.?"
She nodded and smiled at him. When she looked forward again, all she saw were flames. The hill to their right was covered in fire that came nearly up to the road ahead. Huge oak trees writhed in the flames, their blackened branches stripped of all green. To her left, flames had reached the far side of a dry creek bed that meandered close to the road.
"I know where we are, I think."
Her mind was becoming foggy, and it was increasingly harder to think, but she remembered seeing a double-trunked oak on the far side of the creek farther up the road.
"I don't think we have far to go."
Carter walked closer to the road's left shoulder as the angry flames crept up to the right. Emmy had just turned to check on him when she heard an incredibly loud crack. She looked up and saw the blackened, skeletal branches of an enormous tree descending out of the smoke toward them. She was on the ground an instant later, screaming as pain lanced up her legs. Smoke, dancing red motes of fire, and black branches filled her world as she scrabbled at the gravel road to sit up. "Carter! Carter!" she screamed. He was nowhere in sight. Emmy looked down and saw a tree limb across her ankles. She took a breath to scream again, but coughed as searing air and smoke filled her mouth and lungs.
"I'm on fire from the inside!"
She kicked and pulled desperately to free her legs, but the branch was impossibly heavy. Beating it with her fists, she burst into tears of desperation. Every movement seemed to take too long. Every action felt weak. The burning in her lungs crept upward until it was an invisible hand squeezing her throat, causing her to gasp for breath. Dizziness engulfed her as her vision blurred and her thoughts slowed into lethargic submission. She at last lay back, resting her head on the warm stones as she stared at the tree branch, mesmerized by the glowing red embers within it. The pain in her legs was gone now.
"You killed me."
The glow seemed to pulse like a heart, its red eyes observing her.
"You shouldn't do that. Shouldn't kill people."
Her eyes drifted closed.
You've been listening to Volume 1 of The Zombie Chapters by Daniel Feit, read for you by Ethan Sawyer.
Afterward. Can't wait for more? Visit the blog at www.zombiechapters.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.